people generally and fear complexity, and that boils down to reductionism, belief systems, and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, all this, you drill it down, and what you basically have is thought is based on an incomplete database. And so consequently, so is logic. And I think that a lot of what passes for consciousness are really images tied to imagination, which then that gets into semiotics and a lot of complexities where we don't really experience anything directly except through either processes we're not conscious of or language, which is a very comparatively closed system. It's very predictable. And, of course, then that gets back to thought being an incomplete database. So you have all of these architectures, and the way I look at my aim is to deconstruct them, because all of this is based on what could be called liminal experiential anomaly, something at the fringe of consciousness that also equates to interstitial spaces. You know, what's between A and B? And we seem to be filling up that space with architectures when, in reality, the phenomena itself is anti-structural. And what I prefer to do is open up those spaces between A and B and see what's there.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Is that working? Hey there, it's Radio Mysterioso. We had some horrible news this last week. Our friend Bruce Duensing went in for open heart surgery on Tuesday, and on Thursday his daughter sent out a message on Facebook on his page that he had not survived the operation. He'd survived for a couple days, and then he went into cardiac arrest and died on Thursday, I think, morning, which was kind of a shock. And myself and my guests were just getting to know him and starting to communicate with him, and now he's gone. So we're going to talk a little bit about Bruce Duensing and mostly about his thought. And I think probably he would have wanted to hear us talking about his thoughts rather than himself. So with me here are two of my former guests, Red Pill Junkie, who's been on a few times, and Robert, who also known as Burnt State from the Paracast forums, who's been on it once so far. Can you guys both hear me?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I played that little segment. Actually, Robert suggested that I play that little segment at the beginning there from the interview I had with Bruce in early February, because he said it kind of encapsulated what a lot of Bruce Duensing's thought in kind of one quote. and I was setting everything up when I was doing this, so I didn't listen to the quote. Basically, it was, I think what it was is, we are prisoners of our perceptions and our definitions. And I think that might have been, as far as I can tell, the kind of a summation of what Bruce has been trying to tell us for quite a while. Either of you can jump in. Go right ahead. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about Bruce, too, because Robert's done some sleuthing background on him as well.
That was a fantastic summation that you made of that. I find his work so dense, and you kind of pierced right to the heart of it, that we are distracted by these architectures, these things that we've invented, our mythologies, our languages, our incomplete database. And it's through that that we've superimposed some ideas onto the UAP or the UFO that Bruce, I think, in his thinking, identifies as actually quite ridiculous, that it's not as simple as that, and that it's a very complex event, and it's a complex event that seems to be bridging or spanning two different, you know, spaces of the knowable and the unknowable, like a divide between what is human and non-human. And he tries to map out, I think, an in-between environment, and it's not an easy thing to do, but I think that's what makes his writing so exciting.
Yeah, he said between A and B, I think in one of his writing, he might have even said there, we're trying to find out what happens between A and B, because what starts at A, we have no idea, and what ends at B is tangled up in what we are. So what's in between there? What's, you know, what information transfer is happening, you know? I think that's one thing that came up again and again in the show that I had with him. And strangely enough, I say that I'm his friend. I had one telephone conversation with Bruce. It was a nice conversation. It was about half an hour. We talked generally about things. And a little bit more than that interaction in the last few months online. So I won't say that I was a friend, but I was becoming friendly with him and starting to get into his space about what he was talking about, get a little bit deeper into it. So are we going to do Red Pill on the show, or are we going to stay with that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. How did you find out about Bruce's writing, and, you know, how would you sum it up, and what is it making you, you know, kind of go in a different direction?
Well, I found out about Bruce mainly because of his appearance on Radio Misterioso.
Okay.
Prior to that, I really hadn't had a chance to get involved with his blogs. I tried to do that after that, you know. And like Robert said, you know, this with him, it was definitely not Ufology 101, you know. You really had to be on your toes, really try to read and maybe reread a couple of times one single paragraph just to try to absorb as much of the information that he tried to pack, you know, inside one single paragraph. Sometimes it even felt that he was trying to rush himself, you know. He definitely didn't seem to be a friend of Comas when he's in his writing. And at the same time, you know, it was really something. I guess it was difficult for me to read it, because the moment I started to read one single paragraph, my mind started to explode into different ideas, you know, originating from it, you know. So yeah. That is the kind of thing that happens when you are reading something of true depth, you know. The same thing happened to me when I read Mac Tonis's The Crypto-Terrestrials. It is a very, very short book, and yet it took me quite a while to finish it, because every single time I started to read one single page, it triggered 10 different ideas inside me. And the same thing happened with Bruce and in his post, and also when you guys spoke on Radio Misterioso.
Yeah, somebody, Rosanna, on the Facebook Radio Misterioso page said it's definitely not, you know, light reading. And it isn't. And I was talking to Robert earlier, and I said it's not like, you know, where somebody's trying to use this flowery language to show off. He didn't do that at all.
Yeah.
It's just that's what his thought process was. And everything he wrote, there were, just like you just said, there's a hundred sentences encoded into one sentence each of each thing that he says, and you have to kind of pay attention. But like I said earlier, the Robert has done a little bit of sleuthing work on the internet and got kind of a little bit more of Bruce's personality, which I hadn't looked at really. And apparently, he was interested in model trains and antique—not really antique toys, but you know, 1950s, 1960s toys. Things like that. What did you find out about him, Robert, at some of this personal and some of his YouTube videos too, which I didn't even know existed because I didn't look.
Yeah, his YouTube videos kind of caught me off guard because it's a whole collection of model trains, and there's and that was like a big focus piece for him, is that world of the automatic toy. Like a lot of his trains are all O-gauge trains, which are the kind of first the precursors of the electric model train. So it'd be like a wind up clockwork mechanism. So it's all these tin toys that he would wind up and create very, very elaborate, complex platforms inside and outside, multiple trains running at once simultaneously, bridges all over the place, streetcars running in between the towns. And it's like an elaborate, he called it his own art form, like tin toys as an art form. And that's what he was doing there with himself. There's a nice quote, actually, about what he says about it. I just like to read this. Finally finished this side project that reflects my current obsession with vintage O-scale Hornby clockwork trains, which is about as compressed a layout as can be, but it's a lot of fun. From an early age, I've been interested in all things mechanical, especially the forgotten technologies of toys and their history. I know it's done because I cannot fit anything else onto it. It's 3 foot by 4 foot without making the scheme unintelligible. I tried to give the tabletop painting a lithographed look, and then to give the lithographed tin sheen, it was coated with an acrylic sealer. He says that the largest three-rail O-scale layout is currently gathering dust as I indulge in my third or fourth childhood. And I think that's, you know, really interesting that he was so kind of captivated by that world, and that he was finding a part of himself, like multiple childhoods. And he makes reference to that in his very last post, where he talks, there's a Thomas Wolfe quote that, you know, I hope we maybe can read it at the end of the episode, but he opens with a Thomas Wolfe quote that talks about returning to that place of childhood, to the place of time and memory. And I think when you're on the edge of your life, it's not a wonder that we do go back to those places. You know, we go back to the very beginnings of things. It's like a whole other lifetime. It's almost like discovering the UFO. Who was I, you know, many, many lifetimes ago when I was young and little, and can I bridge the gap of time and memory? And he seemed to be doing that in his most recent blog post there.
What did he say in that final blog post? And I didn't say anything when I first saw it because I didn't want to. I was still kind of freaked out and stunned, and I didn't want to say anything about what his final blog post was titled and what it was about.
Well, I was kind of startled also by the title, you know, The Voyages of the Dead. You know, it's kind of interesting to ponder of what exactly elicited that to him to choose that title. Was a premonition? Was that out of a state of depression? You know, I mean, and what I try to understand from it, and also, you know, that quote from Thomas Wolfe that you mentioned, Robert, it affected me. He affected me particularly on a personal level because, like Bruce, this week was also a moment of personal transition for me, for the fact that I was laid off of my 15-year-old job, you know, last Monday. And this idea of that you can't go back to home, to your family and all that. The idea that no matter how much you try, you can't go back to who you were, you know, 15 years, 20 years, 50 years ago, you know, how whether you want it or not, we are always in a constant state of transition. And what you mentioned, that he was so fond of model trains, you know, I think that idea of a system that is in constant motion, moving from station to station, I think that that's kind of a very adequate metaphor for his thinking, and maybe the things that he wanted to deconstruct from the UFO phenomenon.
Yeah, he did. I didn't know about his interest in the trains either. And it's when you were describing this, Robert, it sounds like there's like these things moving around probably in a random fashion on a two-dimensional plane, but they're moving in time and space. It's that when you said lithograph, it sounds like he doesn't have any buildings or anything. It just sounds like it's this flat two-dimensional space with these toys moving around on it on tracks. I mean, maybe that's not true, but it seems like a model kind of for his thinking a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's total three-dimensional mayhem is what it is, with all kinds of different automatic kind of wind-up pieces with little planes flying around in the air. I think he's gone inside some of these engines and placed batteries and lights in there. He had one sequence during Christmas where it was all lit up and there's, you know, buildings and light posts and different things that have kind of illuminated this very surrealist environment. And the lithographed elements come from those original wind-up toy trains, the ones that he was collecting, the clockwork ones where this like giant spring that's inside of them. You just wind it up with a key. And I think that metaphor of the winding up of the automatic object is something that just runs very deep. Like that's his first, I think, toy that he played with. And I think that has imprinted something heavy onto himself because you see him, that one image that's on his blog space is an image of a statue kind of figure pondering over a book as if in deep thought, and the face is a keyhole. There, and he even describes himself on his Google profile, his work occupation as a retired automaton, you know, and kind of seeing himself as that automatic human being.
Yeah, and then through his writing, trying to understand what that automaton comes from, what kind of world it's living in, and how to pull out of that flatland two dimension of the automaton, maybe.
Yeah, you know, this idea of the trains reminds me of Ward Kimball, you know, who is one of the original nine old men, you know, the nine old, the original artist working on the Walt Disney Studio, who was also a big fan of toy trains and whatnot. You know, there must be something about that kind of thing that interests people of great creative and intellectual stature like Bruce and Ward Kimball, you know. And also, you know, it's interesting how this idea of the toy train is also very important in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Maybe there's something that he also was aware of, you know.
Huh, that's funny. Somebody just, one of my friends just messaged me about an hour ago saying they were watching Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and that about a week ago, this is a woman I know, she had a... She woke up in the middle of the night, and there was a voice in the house, and she didn't know where it was coming from, and she ran around the house looking, and she finally found in a drawer a radio that was playing some radio show in the middle of the night, and the radio had been broken, and suddenly it started working and playing these voices. And she said that just today she had turned on the TV to watch Close Encounters, and there was that scene with all the toys starting up by themselves and running around the room. And she asked me what that meant, and I gave her about five different interpretations because I can't stick with one. That's another thing that I talked about with Bruce, and I think he talked about it, was this space or this liminal space or something where things are going on that we have sort of a handle on but not really, and the only way we can get at it is by... What's that? The Charles Fort quote: "We pick up an existence by its frogs." We can only get at it by our metaphors and the way we talk about it. And maybe there's something going on there. And sometimes you get fooled into thinking one thing, and it's something else. And we're, like I said, we're just wrapped up in our metaphors. I am rambling now. So what I wanted to do, the other thing I wanted to ask was probably go through some of the things we talked about in the interview. I actually wrote down some notes. You guys probably did too. One of my favorite things he first said right at the beginning was, "You can't study ufology with ufology," because it hasn't really
agree.
and it hasn't kept up with science. It kind of diverged a long time ago, and it's on its own thing, and became, you know, long ago has become very self-referential. And I think that talking to Bruce and reading his stuff made me maybe go back to basics, kind of like, you know, what are we thinking? How are we thinking about it? and how do we get in these little epiphenomenons of what ufology is and what it's studying and getting further and further away from the source? You know, I think he was pointing that out. It was kind of like standing there ringing a bell saying, look at this, you guys. Look at what's going on here. And I'm glad a few of us could listen to him. Any thoughts on that? I mean, I think I might be restating what I said before, but now I'm trying to get a little bit more specific in that I think more people are going down that road. I see it a little bit more. People are saying, well, here's this new thing that we never thought of. You know, why don't we look at ourselves now? And I think Bruce was in the vanguard of that, you know, 10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on that notion that you brought up in terms of that we need to find a different way to look at things, that we can't come at it the way that we normally do, and we need to come at it from a slant or an angle or an oblique passage. And so One of the ideas that came out for me in his writing was the idea of the menu. He's always got this ongoing theme of the menu, all these different ingredients that we've got to work with. And I thought there was this one little piece where it's kind of like how to cook indigestion at a paranormal dinner party how to cook for indigestion. Because he says that studying ufology with ufology, we've got these limited ingredients that we've got. The database is incomplete. Language and semiotics are representational. The whole thing is just an associative mess. And so he says the best recipes as kind of transient solutions to what do we think is happening inside that fridge of ours or of our reality occur when we're not actually searching for them. And then the recipe, you know, shows up in the form of a gestalt that just appears out of nowhere type of thing.
So you're kind of fooling yourself into looking at something else so that the thing that you were trying to concentrate on reveals itself without critical thought.
Well, certainly that the mistake is that if you keep looking at it directly and trying to figure it out that way, you're never going to get anywhere because you're just filling it in with the confirmation bias piece, the stuff that you already know. So you're using those superimpositions, as he calls them, in existing architectures. And he makes kind of a fun comment about that that's kind of the way that human beings operate all the time. They're always directly looking for answers. And he says, it makes me wonder if we spend most of our existence in a dynamic of unconscious self-sabotage. That we're always trying to destroy ourselves. And if you think about it, in the age of people trying to become good Buddhists and awareness practice, that we're always putting ourselves down. We're always practicing projection. We're always confirming the nature of reality. We're always putting our emotions in front of us or being guided by our emotions instead of stepping outside of that process and that process of disidentification, of kind of seeing yourself from the outside, allows you to maybe look at the UAP in a different way, right? Because he says we're steering ourselves like towards a tree where we're just crashing instead of looking for new open ground. And we need to do it by not looking directly, for the answer to the UAP. He thinks that maybe even the UAP title itself is something you can't digest.
Yes.
This atmospheric phenomenon, he says, is it can't be digested given the limited ingredients we're using in the recipe. It just doesn't taste right. So the idea of the UFO for him, it's just not something that tastes right. And if you're going to come at it, you've got to come at it by not looking at it directly. And that's what makes his writing, I think, super dynamic, is he is always trying to find alternative angles and approaches to consider the problem. And there's just a wealth of material. You could go at it forever going through his work.
Does he make any suggestions anywhere as to how you could not come at it directly?
I think that when you look through his writing, he's always actually coming up, like each one of the titles of one of his pieces is always looking at things differently. And he's kind of got these different processes and themes that are at work there. Like he posted the one piece about UAP in science. And he makes a lot of reference to some of the work that Valet's been doing about creating better filters to vector in on the data and talking about really dynamic kind of processes by looking at data over long periods of time, looking at atmospheric pieces taking place, stellar alignments, gravitational fluxes, looking at clouds of antimatter forming in the atmosphere. Those have been detected. How do all these things parallel sighting reports? Are we seeing, you know, paths of navigation perhaps that are taking place in the atmosphere? And maybe that's a way of helping us to kind of understand it. And he definitely thinks we should throw more science at it and be more diverse in the nature of the filters that we use to think about it. And I think as much as he talks about the UAP in trying to understand that, you know, really strange phenomenon, I feel like in some ways the UAP is actually a metaphor in the world of Bruce Duensing for personal existence, for my own identity there, because I in that last post, everything kind of gets wrapped up with notions of the parallels between UAPs, UFOs, and the ghostly world and the world of right. the afterlife and kind of looking along those patterns. So what I think what Bruce does is just forget the old ways of looking at it. Let's be very broad-minded. Let's be very diverse in our thinking. Let's look at the comparisons that naturally just occur to your brain when your brain's in default mode and see what pops up.
Yeah, he was also – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. It reminded me of this thing that he mentioned on his Radio Mysterioso interview, how a shaman's view of the UFOs they were the dead using a vehicle in order to have a half-life, you know? So that kind of almost is like the similar to the Tibetan concept of the hungry ghosts, right?
Yes.
You know, something that is using our consciousness in order to
experience,
to manifest, you know, to exist in some
to
way.
To experience itself. Yeah, well, that's a very basic idea of, I guess, Christianity or, you know, Western religions, that, and a Hindu religion specifically, I think, which isn't even Western, but that whatever the universal mind was created physicality in order to experience itself, you know, instead mm-hmm. of just being this disembodied whatever or a consciousness without any physicality or anything to pair itself against. You know, there had to be something created so that it would know what it was. And in microcosm, I think Bruce was suggesting that that shaman and also as an example, some of his thinking, that's what's going on with the UFO thing possibly, is that it's, like you just said, Red Pill, is something using our physicality and our consciousness in order to make sense of itself or to be existent for a while. To us, it's for a while. To them, it's it might be a forever thing. It doesn't make any difference mm-hmm. to them. And it's like, to us, it's just this little thing. But to them, it's kind of like, bang, this is I have pulled myself into existence for a while or forever and can live with that. Language is getting in my way, but you know what I'm saying. It's using that experience in order to have some sort of being or existence or sentience, because we were talking. Another thing Bruce talked about was consciousness or existence without, or consciousness without sentience, or existence without mm-hmm. sentience, and that the comparison to the other being us engendered some sort of sentience at least for a while,
which is something that also Mac Tonis speculated about on
yes.
his own blog, Posthuman Blues.
Uh-huh.
You know. I remember that the first time I read it, didn't make any sense to me at all. You know,
yeah, well, intelligence without sentience, that was it.
Yeah. See, I mean, how can an intelligent being be devoid of sentience? You know, are we talking about robots here or what? But now, you know, maybe there might be some kind of way in which a being has, you know, a very, very basic form of sentience that is kind of extracted from the observer in some way. Well, this idea of his of fear as a carrier wave, you know, maybe fear is the mechanism by which these beings extract
identity.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, he'd say we did discuss that when I talked to him about strong emotion and how that might be a carrier wave. And also how it, experiments by Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research and Radin and some other people in the field about with using random number generators and how worldwide catastrophic or emotional laden events would affect the random number generators and cause them to be non-random, and how that might be something to consider, that strong emotion is anti-entropic or inhibits randomness.
Yeah, and maybe how during you also discuss how UFO activity seems to peak during times of historical crises, you know,
yes,
wars, you know, revolutions, conflicts, and makes you wonder, you know, which one is the chicken and the egg, you know? Is it because UFOs are attracted by that, or because so somehow they are triggering that kind of social upheaval, you know, the idea of Jacques Vallée, you know, some cultural thermostat, I think it is.
Yeah.
You know, so we return to the idea of UFO as a system or a component that may have a purpose or it may not have a purpose, you know.
That's right.
Maybe, well, you know. Yeah, sure. Go.
I was going to say one of the approaches, Greg asked, you know, what are some of the different approaches that Bruce was suggesting as to how do we go about investigating the UAP. And so he's got this one post called Behaviorism Beyond Physicality, and he makes these suggestions that perhaps we should be looking at the behaviors of the object and what are the behaviors of these unknown objects tell us, you know, about ourselves as well as the object itself. And he gives an interesting kind of opening sequence where he talks about, you know, the UFO, classic image, the UFO in the middle of, you know, darkness is searching the ground with a large light. And he asks the question, you know, why is it using such a primitive piece of technology as a large flashlight to scan the ground? You know, who is it trying to impress with that, and whose benefit is that for? So he wonders, you know, if the UAP leaves the, you know, very sketchy physical evidence, and he says it's three times removed from the physical objectification of the quarry, you know, the things that we're looking for, it's so removed from it itself. And so he says, well, what's the tool that the detectives should be used to hunt for something that's completely nonsensical?
Yeah.
So that's where he says we should look at the behavior. So let's look at some of the behaviors of the UAP, and he lists nine different kind of behaviors and things that tell us something about ourselves as well as about the UAP. And so number five actually goes with what RPJ just said, that one, the number five has no purpose whatsoever, the UAP. It tells us one piece. Six, it's an energy as a carrier of information. It's a form of encryption that, as you were just talking about, using our own semiotics to present future models, relationships in our models of what reality might be. So the UAP is suggesting something perhaps of what reality really is like, in that, you know, we're kind of missing the picture, but through its behaviors, it's provoking us in some ways. And then he's got another one in terms of one we're familiar with, that there's such a variability in the form, right? All the images and the things that we've seen in the sky over the years, they change constantly. And he says there appears to be some kind of a consistent selection process, which also might be presenting us with some kind of inklings into future realities and models that we should be uncovering. So he wonders, you know, are we being asked through the images and the behaviors we are seeing, are we being asked to decrypt the phenomenon? You know, is it provoking us? Why would it be using a large flashlight? Why is it an airship? Why is it using retro technology? Why is there a screen being pulled down to show Betty and Barney Hill, you know, where they come from? All
and
these
even a map
kind of
for that
things.
Matter. Yeah.
And one of the things that he identifies about it is that it seems to work against normal narratives. You know, all the systems of predictability that humanity relies on so much. And that the way the UAP works is it completely rearranges our system, our ordering system. And in this way, he sees it as, a creative spark of some sort. He says it's ripe with potential, you know. So studying it can perhaps inform ourselves about ourselves is one possibility.
Yeah, well, it appears to people that it's not predictable and nobody ever knows when to expect it. And it's challenging all those things at once. And yes, I was reading down this list as you went down it. The first one is I really like. It suggests our models of causality are incomplete, meaning that we think of things as cause and effect, and what he said on the show, and I talked to him a little bit about it, was that science – I used to say science could not handle the UFO thing. I think that Bruce was right in saying science has gone way ahead of UFO study in finding out that causality is not what we think, and that some models that we have of causality are wrong, where time doesn't work that way, where a cause will come before an effect. I mean, I'm sorry, an effect will come before a cause. Right. And it just looks like that to us, but in the world of non-temporality, not hooked up to time, it doesn't have to make sense in the way that we think of it. And pulling ourselves away from that 19th century model of the way things work is one of the things that it's trying to do. Strangely enough, Bud Hopkins, I saw him doing a lecture once in probably like 1988, and he said that the UFO phenomenon may be dragging us kicking and screaming into a new kind of science of the 21st century. And that's a very simplistic way of looking at it at that time. But I think he had a point there, and Bruce was going a little bit further with that.
Well, there he is investigating those ideas of time and memory, right? That perhaps the UAP is trying to teach us something about time and memory. And these are his eternal themes, like whether he's talking about personal philosophy, his life, or about paranormal and anomalous events, that there's the notion of linearity is limited for us. And that's perhaps an architectural element of our existence we need to throw out the door. And the UAP seems to prompt that for us, for certain.
Or it may be just that UFOs are meant to be injectors of uncertainty, you know, into mm-hmm. our trying to shake us up of our own conformity, you know. And getting back to the idea of fear as a basic component of the experience, you know, when you're in a state of fear and in a state of uncertainty is when you are more open to receive new information, you know, receive a new idea, and to be open to change and to growth, you know. I think that they made some scientific studies in which test subjects were asked to read a short story from written by Kafka, and after that they got better, and you know, in some kind of IQ test, you know.
Well, they got better at solving problems, I think, and looking at them in novel ways.
Yeah, so the idea of injecting some kind of ambiguity, you know, into your life or into your paradigm is actually good, you know, it improves you.
Yeah, fear is a good thing to introduce novelty into your thinking. The other strange thing, and we've talked about this too, is humor and laughter. That also breaks down a barrier which keeps you from, you know, breaks down one of your logical barriers, which may help you think in a little bit more creative way. And a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of people don't watch UFOs and start laughing, but a lot of the things associated with them are completely nonsensical and very funny. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's going on there? It's like I said, it's like a cosmic art project somehow. Looking at it in that way is the effect. I don't know if the intent. I have no idea if there's an intent behind the intelligence that we call aliens, or, you know, running UFOs, or whatever we want to call it. But the effect is that we are frightened, amused, and forced. If you want to admit to the reality of something affecting us, and something being not human, and something being around for thousands of years with us, the reality is that it's continually messing with us, and probably started religions and whole avenues of thought and philosophy that we're not even aware of. But you know, a lot of those were started by knocking people out of their normal way of thinking. And the UFO thing is so strange and so weird, and actually, like you said, so frightening, that I think it's doing that. It's there we are back to the emotion again.
Mm-hmm.
That the carrier wave is being opened up, or the effect of randomness is being introduced again, just to get us going and thinking in a different way, if we choose to accept it that way, which is something that would be nice to have whole conferences of people talking about something like that and see where it can go.
Yeah, and scaring them to death.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Come in and scare the shit out of everybody and see see what happens. Try an experiment at a, you know, at a horror like a haunted house, you know, during Halloween. See what, you know, there's one little piece of the puzzle that might work. I don't know.
Well, fear is not just a great paradigm shifter. It's a paradigm breaker is what it does. It really jogs you completely out of that reality that you were so comfortable in, yeah, in soaking up. And so when you have something that, you know, breaks all of your notions of logic and pragmatism, you get something else that comes at you altogether. I hope you don't mind if I throw another quote at you just because you brought up the Kafka thing, mm-hmm, RPG. And there's a quote from Kafka that Bruce references in his piece where he's talking about, you know, living in an age of commodity and consumerism. And he talks about, I think his work talks a lot about issues of trauma and intensity. And so this Kafka quote says, "I think we ought to read only the kind of books that wound or stab us. If the book we're reading doesn't wake us up with a blow to the head, what are we reading for? So that it will make us happy as you write? Good Lord, we would be happy precisely if we had no books, and the kind of books that make us happy are the kind we could write ourselves if we had to. But we need books that affect us like a disaster, that grieve us deeply, like the death of someone we loved more than ourselves, like being banished into forests far away from everyone, like a suicide. A book must be the axe for the frozen sea within us. That is my belief." And you know, you read some of Bruce's stuff, you can tell there's a really fine mind at work where he is always trying to wind towards a specific thought, a specific startling revelation of some sort, where he is trying to make a transit across contingencies, as he says. You know, that's the title of the blog spaces. He's going on these journeys that takes you through a series of different contingent factors, one being contingent upon the other. And he is trying to break us out of a way of thinking about things. And there's that his quintessential image from the blog that just sits in my mind is the one from Wim Wenders, The Wings of Desire, where the angel is standing on the precipice, kind of looking out over down onto Berlin, the divided city. And I can see that movie is like totally iconic for him in terms of how he thinks about reality and kind of bridging divided spaces, a realm where angels speak and hear everything that we do, like in that one-way kind of mirror where we kind of get a sense that there's somebody behind the mirror, but we can't quite tell what it is. But in that image of the precipice figure, the normal image, you actually see the wings of the angel like in the movie, but in Bruce's image, I noticed that the wings are pretty much gone and dissolved, and there's almost a sense of, it's almost like a quasi-suicidal, semi-reverent, it's a very contemplative image, it's a dark image.
Yeah.
In many ways. And the quote that he puts right beside it, which is from his favorite surrealist, André Breton, is, "It is living and ceasing to live that are imaginary solutions. Existence is elsewhere." And I think that's Bruce in a nutshell. And I guess he's participating perhaps in an elsewhere right now as we're talking there. But that notion that the dipole, like he's always on about, there's a reconciling force in the world, and that reconciling force is something that we need to perhaps to discover. So for him, there's, you know, yes, there's life and there's death, but existence is happening somewhere in a reconciliatory mode between those two. And that's part of that last blog post of looking at the idea of the ghost-like figure or the UAP as ghost, that it's kind of a reconciling space between humanity and non-humanity. And trying to provoke a different identity that we're just unfamiliar with, that we don't have a handle on.
Yeah, well, when he says when Breton says existence is elsewhere, the elsewhere is, I think, what Bruce and all of us who are talking about it are trying to pick up. You know, what is that existence, and does it exist in a way that we can understand? And if it doesn't, how can we start to get a little handle on it? Wow, there's sure a lot of honking going on outside here.
It sounds just like Bruce's train room.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it's as noisy as with all manner of mechanics at work.
Did you say, Robert, that you had seen a couple of videos that weren't train videos on YouTube of Bruce, like one riding his bike, and I can't remember what the other one was.
Yeah, there was a really odd one where it's like him with a GoPro helmet, and it's the most recent video. The most recent one that he's posted is has no narrative whatsoever, and it's just him riding the bike, and he's riding the bike through a really nice piece of suburbia there with beautiful spaced out homes, and in the distance there is a fire, and you can hear sirens, and it's very Radio Mysterioso. It's the edge of something strange is about to happen, and it's just him riding and his perspective from his head. Riding towards the accident and going towards the fire. And if anybody's read his blog, he knows that there's a whole piece in his blog about, you know, his house burning. And I don't know if this is the house or what, but I guess it's a very kind of symbolic, quintessential image of him riding towards the disaster and witnessing this fire as everybody's just kind of standing around watching a deconstructive moment, you know, of reality altering, because that's not what's supposed to happen. Houses are supposed to be built that people live in. They shouldn't be burning to the ground and deconstructing it in such a way. But in that deconstructive process, in that series of images without words, do we not learn something essential about ourselves, about the home that we can't return to, that our identity is not tied in a material object? It's not tied to that home, to that place of memory. It's something beyond that is what we are. And so that was a really interesting vid, that one. And then the other video where he's it's him. And it was kind of neat. And I was hoping to try to edit a piece of it for us to listen to, because he talks about his book. In his book that he's going to be working on, which is about how consciousness is, just like the opening clip that you played, consciousness is imagination, basically. Yeah. It's our imagination and the images that we kind of construct in an internal environment to try to reconcile what we see and create a third world, a third experience of some sort. And he's very big on that idea of triangulation is kind of a running theme in his work. And so so he's shooting himself as a video image and as a digital image. And he starts taking us through a series of different films. And the one film I thought was very interesting, the first film he starts with is Baraka, as he says, a film with no narrative, just a series of images, you know, one after another to try to teach us about, you know, the nature of existence, of who we are on this planet, just through the images and using your imagination to process that. And that's really the essence of his writing and his work with metaphor and his own, you know, constant return to poetics in his language.
Robert, you have been really deeply affected, probably more than me, by Bruce's work and writing here. And it's amazing to hear some of your views and comments on what you found out about him, because it gives me and everybody that's and Red Pill and everybody that's interested in him a little bit deeper understanding of where he was coming from, what his main themes were, and his attempt to communicate that to people. And there's only a few people who I think are going to hook into that and carry it forward. And I hope that at least I'm worthy enough to do a little bit of that. I contacted his daughter on the day that Bruce passed away and made sure that I had some contact with her, because I wanted to ask her about doing something like archiving his website, or websites, if the other one could be brought back. Maybe he didn't want that because he started this new one, but keep this transit of contingencies alive and posted somewhere so that it can just stay there for people to see and go back through his writing. I don't think there's going to be a book. It sounded like he was thinking about writing a book, but hadn't actually gotten too far with it. So I don't think there's a manuscript or anything. I guess I will ask her, but like I told Robert and RPJ earlier here, I don't particularly want to bother the family here for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, of course.
It would be nice to collect the work in the way that Mac Tony's work was collected together. And although I think with Bruce's, what would be very handy is to have an interpretive guide to go along with it, to kind of understand some of those pieces there. And
well, maybe
I want to thank you for
printed. Yeah.
I want to thank you, Greg, for the compliment you threw at me. But I have to say, reading Bruce's stuff is—I'm sure everybody's had that experience. You know, you read something that you plug into, and you go, "Whoa, that's how my brain's working." You know, I can't identify with all of the depths of places that Bruce goes to. That space that he talks about, that in between space. Well, that was, you know, the poetry I was writing first year in university was the borderline between the doorway. You know, between entering somewhere and exiting somewhere. What's in between that space? That's the place I'm really interested in. And so, reading reading Bruce's work has kind of taken me back to that initial idea of thinking about, you know, existence as an in-between zone, and certainly things like UFOs, ghosts, and paranormality dwell very richly in that liminal zone, do they not? And I think Bruce plugs directly into that and brings it alive in a way that not too many writers are able to do.
Yeah,
it's like that quote in the last Indiana Jones movie, no? Right, that the flying saucer disappearing, and that one character, the one that was mad the whole of the movie, and then suddenly recovers his sanity and saying, "No, they are returning to the space between spaces," you know. Mm-hmm. And I know that you, Greg, are particularly fond of that quote because it's like the best explanation for UFOs ever put in a popular science fiction movie.
Yeah, that line actually floored me. It's like watching the whole movie and it's like, this is fun, this is silly. And then that comes in and it's like, who wrote that? Who decided that was going to go in the movie? That is like a key. That's like a key. If you have one, that's one key you need. And this is what we're talking about tonight, and what Bruce was about too, is that key of the existence is elsewhere, and their existence was elsewhere. And if you had one way to describe what it might be like, or a metaphor of what the existence of the UFO or UAP comes from, or whatever causes it comes from, is that the space between the spaces, the time between the times. There is one thing that Bruce said and is written about, and I'm still struggling with, and either of you can try and tackle this. He said that energy, and he said that Valet had gotten this, had said this, and probably he had gotten it from Valet. Energy and information are the same thing. How do either of you reconcile? What does that mean to you?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think I read in one of his posts that to him the idea of visualizing consciousness as music, it was a very adequate metaphor, and I agree, because that way you can say that information is coherent energy. You know, I think that Jacques Vallée talks about how you could expend the same amount of energy playing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or playing pure cacophony out of the instruments, you know. The same energy has been spent, but one is a beautiful symphony and the other is just noise. So what is the difference? The difference is how, in one example, the energy has been modulated in some form of coherent transmission, you know. So it elicits the desired effect, and in the other, it's just gibberish. So that's, I think, that is the key difference between, for me, maybe not for Bruce or Jacques Vallée, between pure energy and information.
In terms of the energy information, you know, he referenced the Jacques Vallée TEDx event, right? That we need a physics of information to kind of to move us forward. And I think that's... Bruce talks about that in kind of even defining himself as a human being, because in his profile piece, he talks about himself of where he's employed. One of the places he's employed is in the Big Bang. And in the Big Bang, he went from storage to transmission in waves that became molecules in a self-organizing energy system within a conscious universe. Yeah. So he sees himself as something that started as that energy wave that then became something organized and physical. And yes, everything is information, right? And information's coming at us from all sorts of different places and sources. In his profile piece, he says that under education, he lists only one location where he was educated: dreams. And in dreams, he was present. And so in there is this, you know, cavalcade, our own imagistic library, where there's the brain processing reality, physical reality that we see as, you know, light reflecting off of objects. And so for us, it is just, you know, energy being relayed into the mind that then superimposes a reality on top of it as the brain is, you know, trying to process that experience. So it is an informational environment. And the trick to it all is, how can we decode or decrypt the fact that that information is coming to us in all these different manners, and he seems to identify the UFO or the UAP can be both or neither, that they appear as energy and then it transmits information to us, especially if you start to explore any place around with that a little bit, exploring the idea of the abduction scenario, you know, as a moment of communication of some sort that we should be interpreting to try to understand what's being communicated to us. Is that also taking place only in dreams? They seem to be interchangeable, but I think what he argues for is there's something else at work. There's a third zone. There's something that the UAP is trying to show us that it's not just energy or information. There's something else in an in-between state. And perhaps that's the music that, you know, that RPJ was talking about. That's the jangly music that we suddenly hear is, oh, there's the light in the sky. There's something amazing that we're looking at, neither energy nor physical, something else altogether.
There's a lot of information encoded, I mean, represented as energy when you just think of an inspiration you have. All that energy that you would expend into coming, bringing that imagination or that idea into fruition, it's all encoded in that inspiration and that idea. Does that seem to make sort of sense in the same way?
Yeah, but there's also the personal interpretation, right? Because, for example, if I play Rammstein music to my father, he will say that it's just noise, you know?
Yeah.
Horrible, horrible noise. Whereas if I play, you know, Beethoven Fifth Symphony to a punk rocker, you know, he will just, you know, feel that his ears are bleeding, you know? So a UFO sighting could be either the most blissful and incredible experience of your life or the most horrible or most traumatic. And in some cases, that has been the case with witnesses. You know, some people have been left scarred by the event. It has completely wrecked their lives. And others have experienced an incredibly positive transformation and uplifting of all their ideas on all their spiritual life and whatever. So what makes the difference, you know?
You know, you say that just now, and you know what I just thought of was Timothy Leary's Set and Setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ah, excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, what makes the difference in a psychedelic experience, he said, as between good or bad, is the set, meaning what is your background, what is your mental state, what is your, you know, your intelligence level, all these things that go into making your psychological makeup, and maybe even physical too. And setting, where does it happen? Are you amongst friends? Are you in a police station? Are you at a sporting event? Are you in a quiet room by yourself? All these things are going to make a difference in how your psyche interprets, uses, and more importantly, digests a strange event. And maybe that's what's going on with the, you know, why people have so much widely varying experiences with the other, the thing that we're talking about, the intelligence or whatever it is behind these strange events. Adam Gorightly says, why the preference of some of late of UAP over UFO? I'll tackle that. I think it's because they don't want the semiotic baggage that comes with unidentified flying object.
That's right.
And they try to change it to unidentified aerial phenomena, which yeah. It's fine. But the thing is that you're backing yourself into another corner, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was using it only because that's what Bruce tend to be using a lot on his site as well. But I just
shorthand.
Wanted to make a mention about the set and setting piece there and the kind of parallels between the hallucinogenic experience with entheogens and the UFO or UAP experience that when, you know, when the hallucinogenic event clicks, when set and setting is righteous, There is an opportunity for you to get unhooked from time, as you've often talked about, where all of the associations that you have with certain events, experiences, images are broken completely and get to be reordered, reshuffled, reinterpreted now through the imagination and through a very powerful kind of imaginary boost given to you through that entheogen that allows you to put together a whole new mythology. Like you get to reassemble a whole new way of understanding the self. And often, as I've heard many people describe, you know, the hallucinogenic event through via entheogens is it gives your head a rinse. You know, it's an opportunity to kind of shake things loose and perhaps see things a little more clearly and a little more accurately. The UAP, on the other hand, because it is such a new reordering of things, if that individual is perhaps not in a good set or setting, then deconstruction follows. And that, Bruce talked about that on the episode with you, and I talked about that on the episode with you as well, too, when I was on, about how there can be a complete utter breakdown when the reality you are is so predictable that you are familiar with completely breaks and falls apart. Something new is being provoked in the mind of the witness there. So then does the UAP require a certain type of witness to be present to be able to take it in perhaps and order it or participate in the reordering of reality in a way that makes sense for an individual?
Yeah, well, the same thing happens sometimes when people have bad trips, quote unquote, is that they like you said, they've been rearranged, but they don't have anything to replace the rearrangement with. I had a friend that went through this, and he actually called up the Stanislav Grof used to have this group called the Spiritual Emergency Network, and they would deal with people that had quote unquote bad trips, or even something where they didn't have a they were in existential crisis, meaning it was kind of, you know, the very basic thing to say is like, you know, why bother? And I think what they tried to do at that point was get to the point where that question, why bother, became immaterial, to the point where you're not asking that question and looking at it in terms of existence and non-existence and, you know, does it mean anything or does it not mean anything, and being okay with that. I don't know. Maybe there's that they have abduction experiencer groups and people that are supposedly helping people. But like Robert said in our interview, maybe just somebody that's smart that can let the person talk is part of the solution of existential crisis when you have some kind of a experience of where your reality and your underpinnings, your psychological underpinnings are cut loose.
Yeah, I think he mentioned something about provoking a question into the experiencer, not telling him or her what to think, but to help him or her to reach to that answer completely on their own. You know, that's the job of a competent psychotherapist. You know, they don't just go out and say, well, you know, you feel like that because you secretly hate your father, you know?
Yeah.
it will be completely pointless, you know? You have to let them have that, what they call a breakthrough, you know, which ironically, I think it's the title of one of Whitley Strieber's books, you know, the second one after Communion, you know? So you need to have that breakthrough, but it has to happen out of your own volition, you know, and maybe some people resist and they never reach that state.
Well, that was a revelation to me when Robert said that.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, because Robert, you used that example of a friend of yours that was had a psychotic break or something like that, mm-hmm. and was having problems, and you just sat there and talked to him for probably, you said, many hours over an evening
that's
or something.
Right.
And he finally, you know, realized that what did you say to him? Like,
replaying back the things that he was saying to me because I think that's transactional analysis, you know, good listening is rephrasing what the person has said and kind of reordering it so that they can hear themselves. And then we have what, as Bruce often describes, a feedback loop, right, that's being created. And he was allowed in his own existential crisis of the schizophrenic breakdown to perhaps see a reshuffling and a reordering now of the images and events and experience of his life in a way that made current traumas more understandable, or the source of the trauma more understandable. And he realized he was, you know, just deeply afraid that the woman that he loved was never going to come back to him again, and he would be abandoned the way that his mom abandoned him when he was younger. And, you know, that got fed back to him, and he got to see it with some clarity when he heard it, and then when he restated it himself. And I think that's a very handy way to understand reality.
Yeah. Robert, I think you also mentioned in your interview with Greg how nowadays it has been learned that it's best with people who suffer with what we call schizophrenia, you know, people who hear voices, that instead of, you know, ignoring the voices, you know, or pretending that the voices don't exist, then it's actually much more beneficial or therapeutic to actually listen to the voices, you know, and eventually that actually makes the patient, you know, get better.
In some cases, you know, in some cases the voices are pretty low end, and they don't scare you, and they're not too big a deal as that bicameral mind starts operating. But other times the voices are totally horrific and are telling you to do terrible, evil, malicious things, and they shouldn't be listened to. It. And sometimes maybe we do need some drugs to calm things down that are happening spontaneously from a side of ourselves that we have no control over.
Have you guys heard of the Dr. Tanya Lundberg? I think it's her name.
No.
So she writes for the New York Times. She has a column, and she's she's a psychological anthropologist or something like that. So she studied people who hear voices, and she learned that there is actually a cultural difference between how people perceive voices in different countries. So people, the voices in Italy, you know, are not as mean as the voices that are heard by Americans or something like that, you know. So, which is kind of interesting.
Cultural encoding.
Yeah, so this idea that the voices will always, you know, ask you to kill your parents, you know, or something like that, maybe that's only strictly from an American point of view, you know.
Or there might be something going on deeper than that, that's not just not cultural encoding to the individual, but cultural encoding to the collective, or wherever you're pulling those ideas out of, that those voices are, you know, you could be a very bad receiver for some of those things if they're not coming from yourself, which I hate to jump into that kind of space, but you know, I think it's a legitimate question.
Yeah, well, for example, I don't know if you guys learned that John Nash, the famous Nobel Prize winner,
what is it called?
A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah, Beautiful Mind. Yeah,
so he and his wife were killed in a car accident.
Yeah, a couple months ago.
But the interesting thing about Nash was how, when he was having his worst schizophrenic episodes, was also the time when his creative output was at its peak. You know, so that's kind of interesting, the idea how, you know, there's on the one hand we reject the people who experience these mental states, but on the other hand, if we kind of learn to cope with them or maybe take advantage of them, like in some other cultures that we deem to be primitive, we might get very unexpected benefits. You know, I read something on how a psychologist who also happened to be an African shaman, you know, once visited a psychiatric hospital, you know, in the United States, and his opinion of it was that it was a waste. You know, he saw that with such sadness, how people who are having this, what he will consider to be spiritual crisis, and they are just treated as, you know, rejects, you know, defective individuals who need to be put away, you know, so they can't bother or contaminate the rest of us, you know. whereas in other cultures, those are the people who are considered to be as conduits to the spiritual world, you know. So they have something valuable to give to the village or to the people.
Yeah, but it's a rare person that can balance that and balance between those two worlds without being consumed by it, I think, at least psychologically.
Well, you know, that article that I read about, I think an article from the posted on the Washington Post about how a man let his schizophrenic son to be go on a trip to Africa with a shaman, and after the trip, you know, the son who had spent so many years, you know, institutionalized in the United States,
yeah,
actually got better, you know, to the point that he now could take care of himself. You know, I mean, it wasn't, you know, like a miracle cure,
right?
But since the shaman treated him as an equal, as a peer, actually,
yeah,
you know, he knew the things that needed to be done in order to help this boy, you know, to resolve this state of spiritual crisis. Kind of like in the book, which I haven't read, but I plan to one day, you know, Black Elk Speaks.
Oh, yes, yes.
How, mm-hmm. Yeah, so this Native American boy, you know, is having this spiritual crisis, and it's detected and interpreted by the tribe as, you know, the boy needs to is passing, it's open to the spiritual world, you know, and instead of, you know, putting them away or expelling him from the tribe, the whole tribe helps him to resolve the crisis. I think they actually, you know, recreate this dream that the boy is being obsessed or traumatized by, and because they know that that is a sign of that the child is called to become a shaman.
This is a great story, and I think treating people in that way would have a much better cure rate. There's probably no magic bullet, obviously, but mm-hmm. It would be nice to have people treated as, you know, in some way, like Robert said, and in some way, like you said about this article, as people with who have fallen off the path and need to be sort of shown that they could be back on the path, and they just have to climb up the hill themselves while you stand there. In some ways, what the other thing I was thinking of while as we were talking was that perhaps there's a way, you know, is there some kind of talk therapy that we could have with the phenomenon and our well, I think we're doing it right now. with the phenomenon and our ideas about it, to kind of reconcile them and get to the point where we recognize how we got to the place we're at now. I think that's kind of what Bruce was doing. He was kind of doing talk therapy with everybody.
I was going to draw a parallel, actually, between that kind of schizophrenic, the integration of a schizophrenic mode of thinking, which is definitely not predictable, is much more random, seems to come from the outside, and paralleling that to some of the ideas that Bruce Duensing has. Because when you take a look at kind of European pragmatism as kind of a thought mechanism that has guided, you know, North American thinking, you can see how somebody like Bruce, who's got such a wonderful breadth of language, vocabulary, and disciplines, is able to, in fact, take himself to the edges of the liminal state and see a little outside of that normal mode of thinking. And I wanted to make the connection between his other great love, which is surrealism. And we talked a little bit about André Breton before. But when you look at his work, he echoes ideas of surrealism over and over again. And when you look at what surrealism is defined by Breton, is it's pure psychic automatism. And he took that term from the idea of mediumistic automatism and automatic writing and those things. But what he wanted to say, that it's not about channeling the dead. That's not Breton's idea. It was the idea that almost that in the post-industrial era or living, you know, in the midst of the industrial era, that we are now a clockwork mechanism that has been wound up, and that what we must reject within ourselves is the kind of And then the machine-like automatism that doesn't allow us to tap into creative processes that are inherent in who we are as people there. And there's a quote that Du Wensing integrates into one of his pieces from Breton that says, "But we who have made no effort whatsoever to filter, who in our works have made ourselves into simple receptacles of so many echoes, modest recording instruments, who are not mesmerized by the drawings we are making, perhaps we serve an even nobler cause." And I think that's what Du Wensing was talking about when he talks about this conceptual matrix of the UAP as the mask that has no mask, and that this goes to these deconstructions of surrealism, that he feels that perhaps there is some kind of secret design perhaps that's at work there that we're constantly kind of perplexed by the way that we look at it, that these superimpositions that defy description and that the language we use for it perhaps is very limiting, and that we've created a schizoid trap for ourselves by calling it something when in fact what we need to do is lower those guards of kind of pragmatism and predictability and our own paradigms of North American thinking, consumer thinking, and we need to go into that pure psychic automatism. And he speaks about that at the end of his Voyages of the Dead article about the relationship to psi phenomenon and how psi phenomenon is something that needs to be perhaps awakened and celebrated as another part and function of ourselves that maybe we've killed in our own culture and the history of our culture that's turned us into automatons and not very good ones at all. When in fact, when you look at Bruce's writing, there's a deep, wonderful imagination that dwells in metaphor and is provoking the reader of his work to be inventive and to try to come up with new ideas to see themselves as even more than what you came into the writing in the first place with.
Yeah, he reminds me of another person that I admire greatly that I've interviewed, and I said this to one of you earlier today. When I'm interviewing a person or talking to a person that I have to keep up with and they're thinking ahead of me and they're inviting me to follow them along, that's a great conversation, and it helps me learn and it makes me think, and I'm doing that right now with both of you. Bruce did that, and Dean Radin did it. And what I find with those kind of personalities is that they've got a foot in the pragmatic, scientific left brain, but they also have a very, a very solid foot in the right brain, creative, nonlinear too, and that's where a lot of new thought and synthesis comes from. Because if you spend too much time in either of those, you start spinning off into on the right brain side, you start spinning off into things that only make sense to you, maybe, and if you can't communicate that to people, it might be kind of useless. And on the other hand, if you're too pragmatic and too scientific to the point of rejecting the creative side, the subconscious, that is a detriment to any progress in that area too. So, like the shaman who can walk between the two worlds of the off the grid world, the not on the reservation world of thought, and then on the other hand be able to communicate that to people in his tribe and to people that listen to him in a way that can help them, that's a rare thing. And I think Bruce had that, and he's trying to engender that, like any good artist, writer, researcher, whatever you want to call it, any good thinker, he's trying to engender that into other people. One, to invite them to come along, and two, to say, I've done this. Can you reflect any of this back to me and pull us a little bit further? Maybe you can go further than me. I think that's what he was doing.
Yeah, which resonates also with what you and Paul Kimball have been saying for quite a while now of seeing UFOs as an art project, right? As a vehicle in order to, like the surrealist, to channel their subconscious, if not the dead, their subconscious energy, and to flow, to let their creativity flow.
Yeah,
I agree completely with that. I think that's exactly where Bruce is kind of going on about at the in that closing article, is that concept of that we are trying to seek a, that in the Voyages of the Dead, that there's a resurrection that's being sought, you know, and a resurrection of ourselves by donning these borrowed masks, he says, and what's created are those the idea of the ghosts of ourselves that are being seen in a future tense. And he's got a really interesting subtitle to that last piece, which is the present possessions in a past tense, as if he's almost taking stock of himself or looking at himself from a future perspective to take a look at what's happening right now. And I guess we can't hear his perspective on that. But one of the things he definitely challenged with that Thomas Wolfe quote, he kind of identifies, well, you can't return to the point of origin. That home is, you know, for us often, home is about trying to escape back to time and memory, back to the things that we're familiar with, which is what he did with the train sets there, and discovering his pure identity as a child there, you know, and remembering all those wonderful shadowy bits of ourselves, you know, seeing the UFO, being held by our dad, belonging to a place that really doesn't even exist in time anymore. And what he's, I think, trying to affirm is that we dwell in the imaginary. We dwell in the liminal. We live constantly in a state of personal fantasy. And what the UAP may be reminding us is that we are self-constructors. We construct ourselves in this space, and we make art out of our own lives. And we have choices that we can make and how we make that art. It can be predictable, or it can be a little bit more random and more investigatory and really pushing ourselves to the fringes of our own experiences and fringes of our ideas of self.
The point is, yeah, just pushing yourself. And like you said earlier, Robert, is like the surrealist and like Kafka was saying, you know, don't – you're doing things and encountering things and producing things that change, jar, scare, whatever it is, and not always with a goal in mind. It's like, I'm going to scare people and make them do this. It's more like I'm going to jar myself and other people out of this, off this rail that we're on right now, and maybe see what other rails exist, or if we don't have to be on a rail at all. And see what we find that way, you know, like, you know, wandering. If you, one of my favorite things to do is when I'm on a trip is just to wander. I can't stand it when there's a plan. And, you know, Anthony Bourdain does this in his show. He really encourages people, don't go do these normal things. Just walk out and don't, with no expectations and see what happens. And I think that there's not a lot of that going on especially in UFO, you know, study groups or among people or whatever you want to call it. Some of it goes on, I think, in the parapsychology. In fact, I think that's probably where the most creative thought is going on. Almost none of it with people that are into ghosts and Bigfoot and things like that. They're pretty much stuck in the physical. So it's incumbent upon these different, you know, cryptozoological and crypto, whatever you want to call it, studies of anomalies, for people to maybe do something that doesn't seem like it makes any sense, or something completely useless, crazy, or whatever it is, and see what happens. Like William Burroughs did with his paintings, with the, you know, shooting a shotgun at bags of paint. What do we gain by throwing ourselves into the world of randomness and unpredictability? Because guess what? That's where the UFO thing lives. It lives in randomness and unpredictability. Is there some way, Bruce is pushing us to this, you guys are too, is there some way to push ourselves into that same realm so that we kind of live in that space for a while and see what happens with new eyes, non-judgmental eyes and minds?
That's scary territory.
That's really scary, and it makes me very happy and excited until I get the crap scared out of me, then maybe not.
Yeah, because either we push ourselves or we are going to get pushed by life anyway, you know?
And yeah, that's right.
We're going to be pushed into the fear of losing your job, as in my case, losing your house, as it was Bruce's case, you know, because it was burned to the ground, or even, well, losing his son. I think he also mentioned in that Radio Misterioso interview that his son had died a few years ago, you know, and then how that elicited that thought he was thinking about how we are all just guests in someone else's mansion, you know. And then he mm-hmm. received this like confirmation, this uh-huh.
Oh yeah, I think you should describe what happened, what he said. And he said it scared his wife quite a bit.
Yeah, but he didn't scare him, you know. He was just like something of a curiosity to him, you know. Not, maybe not a confirmation or something, but you know, maybe just a little hint.
Yeah, he said that was a voice that was. He said it was louder than normal. Voice mm-hmm. just came into his head when he had that thought and said, "Uh-huh." That's perfect. I mean, I think he was in a state where, you know, I think that would have happened. I mean, if it had just been a normal day, he would have never heard that. I don't think. It wouldn't have been something. And who knows where that came from? That might be self-referential. It might come from outside him. Maybe it doesn't make any difference. Maybe that's the point.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it was, you know, like skeptics trying always to explain away synchronicities or miraculous apparitions or whatever, you know, like someone posting a photo of little girl, you know, and behind her there's some kind of weird image in the photo that kind of looks like the Virgin Mary, and you know, and the family of the girl happens to be Catholic, so they say, oh, so the Virgin Mary is protecting her, you know. And there's always going to be the skeptics saying, no, well, you know, the image is the result of the blurring of the camera and this and that, you know. And you can maybe you miss the point, man, you know. It doesn't really matter. That what matters is the interpretation that
right.
The girl's family is giving it to her, you know, and if a blurry image gives them some level of comfort, you know, who are you to deprive them of that?
Yeah, and on another level, it's like, you know how scary, one of the scariest or most difficult things is to unhook from that. Is it there or is it not? Is that true or was it not? Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for that? I mean, well, there's a reason. That's a real basic question. But sticking with that duality is really easy to do. It's really hard to get away from the duality thinking. I think Bruce, the other thing he was trying to do was pull us away from that and realize that we are trapped in this dualistic thinking, and that, you know, opinion, emotion, background, set and setting, all this stuff is pulling us. Always pulling us towards an interpretation, and we're lost already as soon as we start running towards an interpretation, I think, in a lot of cases with some of this weird stuff.
Uh-oh.
There we go.
The hardest thing is not to reach a conclusion or interpretation, you know, to remain at that level of uncertainty. And boy, is it hard.
Sorry.
Answers.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. You got unplugged somehow. He's very good at that, you said.
Okay, that he was not interested in just finding answers. He was more interested in asking questions. And I think people who have experienced intensity in their lives or profound trauma, and as a parent who's buried their child, that's certainly a reordering of the normal processes of life. So that's a major deconstructive experience for an individual to go through. And I know he expressed on the show with Greg, you know, that there was some guilt there. But what I got a sense was that his experience and the experiences that he had in his life, his mind was flexible enough for him to allow those things to provoke him to ask more questions. To ask more questions, to dwell in those fringe spaces, dwell in those liminal zones. And he seemed to be looking for what he described in one of his blog posts, these kind of acts of reconciliation. And so you were talking about the duality piece, and I wanted to bring up one of his great, I thought, concepts and pieces of triangulation and triadic systems and triadic ordering. And so one of his blog posts is called The Physicality of Metaphysics, and he kind of takes us through this notion that the root word of religion in Greek denotes the idea of relinking. relinking like the known and the unknown. So he sees this as the narrative of symbolism. You know, what's the purpose of symbolism is to link known and unknown things, a shared dream of superimpositions, he says. And so he describes the way that people live is we live between the historical world of our environment, you know, of our set and setting, and our inner world that the mind creates, and that out of that process, there's a third world that gets created, that of reconciliation. So we experience reality, and then we internalize it, and then we have to then work with that, and that's the reconciliatory action. So he goes on this kind of series of ideas then about how, and he quotes a series of different people and involves, again, many multiple disciplines, but he talks about how, you know, two lines, you know, are run parallel to each other. It takes three sides to enclose a plane and to create an enclosed environment. You need three dimensions to create a solid space being defined, and then he continues with the religious narrative, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, negative charge, positive charge, reconciled by a grounded neutrality. Then he takes us into the solar system, and his mind starts to imagine, you know, energy pieces working. If you cut a planet in half, you know, and there's a pole that's running through there. How is, you know, the ordering of the universe itself, perhaps a series of triadic ordering events? And then can we see this in anomalies? Are the anomalies also a triadic system that's organizing that interspatial space, you know, the place between A and B? And he asks, is there a dipole that produces a strange music to our senses, resulting in something not physical or non-physical, but rather a reconciling force? Is that strange music the UFO? Like that one I really had difficulty in kind of working my way through. He had layered it so well, but by the time you get to the end of it, you're puzzled. What is this reconciling force? Is that the UFO? Is that what we see? Or is that the, you know, the music, the sounds that it makes resonating in us? Is that pointing something out to us? That is an act of reconciliation of some sort, some transit, again, transit of contingencies.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the idea of the triad, you know, has been mentioned by Whitley Strieber, you know, a lot in his books of communion and all that, how it seems to be heavily linked with the phenomenon somehow, you know, the beings moving in three groups, you know, having some kind of triangle symbol in their uniforms or whatever, you know. There seems to be a very deep meaning about the concept of the triangle or the triad, and so how the reconciliation between opposing forces, you know, and reaching a balanced state.
Yeah, I was thinking of two things while you were talking about that. One was when I was going through a course of Western occultism, we had to diagram numbers, and one was represented the, you know, creation or existence. Two represented duality, something to create to compare the existence with, and three was a consciousness. That was that allowed the one and two to be observed as a duality, and I can't remember what the other thing I was thinking of was. It had to do with Robert, what did you just say about what Bruce had said? Oh, the reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
He might have mentioned it in the thing there, but I think the reconciliation is going to be through us and through an interplay of what we reconcile as, you know, whatever the thing is that caused the incident or whatever we witnessed or however it affected us. Somewhere in that is the reconciliation between what we know, what we experience, what's normal, and what that weird thing that happened is. I get, you know, we're the third part of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does make sense.
Yeah, it hurt to say that. I mean, I was closing my eyes and trying to get the words properly out and not say too much. We've got we got 20 minutes left. Go ahead.
I remember that when I heard for the first time your interview with him, and when I listened to his, what the kind of question that he would like to ask to to an alien being, you know, if he mm-hmm. ever saw one, you know, what am I? You know, it kind of made me think about this. I remember writing about it in a comment on the Radio Mysterio Show page about Betty Hill's star map. You know, how when she asked the leader of the aliens, you know, where they came from, you know, and he goes and draws up the map. And, you know, the first thing that he asks is, can you locate yourself in this map? He asks Betty, and she says no, you know, and then he kind of gets annoyed and said, well, if you don't know where you are, you know, there's no point in telling you where I come from, right? So it makes me wonder, you know, are we so obsessed with this phenomenon, with the UFO, because we need it as some kind of mirror in order to perceive ourselves? Is that why we are so obsessed with finding the other, because we need it as a reference point?
I think it needs it as a reference point as much as we do.
Yeah, maybe that's the reconciliation, you know.
Maybe it is, but then, we're, you know, see, I'm thinking in duality again and screwing it all up.
What do you think, Robert?
Do you know this short story? It's a Latin American short story called The Third Bank of the River. I don't know how to pronounce the name. João Guimarães Rosa is the name.
Brazilian?
Pardon?
Sounds like Brazilian person.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's a fascinating story that kind of has some weight to what we're talking about here. And in the story, what happens is a father built it's called the Third Bank of the River, which, you know, river has two banks. It sits very nicely in Bruce Duensing land. And what happens is a father builds a canoe, and the family's wondering what he's up to. And he builds the canoe, and he goes and he paddles out to the middle of the river, and he doesn't return home. And the family's like wondering what's going on, and they go leave some food out for him. And sometimes he takes it, and this goes on for days, then weeks, then months, years. They realize he's never coming back. He's staying out there on the river, and his daughter gets married, has a son, and hopes dad will come see it and doesn't bother. Then his son comes to the river, and he yells out to the river, says, "Father, father, your job is done. Come back here with the canoe, and I will take your place." And suddenly the father starts canoeing towards him. There, and the son freaks out, and he takes off and runs away, and the father's never seen again. And then the son, you know, at the end of the story, longs for a place to die, which is inside of a canoe. And I think that in that notion of trying to find oneself, which I think Bruce was very bent on, was an examination of what is the nature of humanity. And so the UAP for him becomes metaphor. It's a touchstone. It's a right. measuring device. It's a methodology or a modality to kind of take a bead on himself from so many different possible perspectives and angles. So I think as much as he's studying the behaviors of UAPs, he's really and that happened in the episode with Greg, as he was talking about the witness experience. And I think he's talking about the experience of witnessing life. You know, and that we all perhaps perceive ourselves in the middle of the river and looking for a third bank to rest on. But life is so bizarre and so surreal, really, at its notion. I think the UFO tries to remind us this all the time. We're not living in normalcy. We're living in a hallucination. It's just our brain is trying to order it to make it predictable and simple. But in fact, it's not that simple. It's much more complex. Things deconstruct all the time. Sons die before fathers do. And you must measure and take a bead on yourself and find that place to occupy, even if it's in that liminal in-between zone, because sometimes that's the only place you can make sense of yourself and make sense of what's going on.
Yeah, like temporarily schizophrenic friend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to make sense to other people, but it has to make sense to you.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the UFO thing might lie. The solution to that, unfortunately, might be, like Whitley Strieber said, a very democratic thing, where the meaning is revealed to each person individually.
That's correct. And I think we have a duty to self in that process, as all revelations unfold in front of us, we have a duty to self to explore those images, those revelations within ourselves, because really what we're reconciling is our own existence.
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
And if you're not, I guess you're that automaton again.
Absolutely.
And go ahead.
I was going to say life in North America compels us to be that automaton. And I thought that's what was interesting about Bruce's profile piece of identifying himself as a retired automaton. He was a cog in a machine, and now he's playing with trains looking for a new childhood and still working at, you know, Being Human Incorporated, which I thought was quite hilarious.
I just had a thought, and I think I alluded to it earlier, that I think Bruce was kind of a high-level artist with words
totally.
And thoughts. And not, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people think it's like, well, he's a philosopher, or he was, you know, formerly a I don't know if he was a scientist. I think he had some scientific background. I could be wrong. He said he was in charge of some sort of when I talked to him, he said he was in charge of some sort of scientific project or having to do with technology, and that he had retired from that. They had recently hired him back to do it because he was one of the few people that knew how to do it, and they valued his input. But I think at heart, like I said, like all great scientists, researchers, thinkers, they're artists at heart.
Uh-huh.
They're trying to communicate uh-huh. something that is is not easily communicated in language. And some people go to poetry. Some people go to music. Some people go to painting, visual arts. And I think Bruce is trying to do it with words. And he was struggling with trying to get these concepts through language that were not amenable to language.
So can I give you the quote that goes directly with that statement?
Yes,
from
please,
him?
Please do.
So at the very closing of his, and this is what Paul Kimball quoted as well on his rest in peace piece that he put on his blog space. But the
Thank
closing
you,
of Voyages of the Dead, Bruce says, "In every fiction, there's an element of truth. And the same could be said by reading that statement in reverse order." And so this writer thinks on poetics as a series of observations that indirectly point to a reality not directly manifested in their sentences. The same may apply to us. And I think in there, he says exactly what you're talking about, that for him, it's poetics of observations as a series of observations, that the poem is a series of observations that's pointing out to something else that is not there directly in what it's saying to us, but it's indicating another process. And I think most high-level artists talk all the time about invisible processes that are happening all around us that we just don't see or pay attention to, but that's a natural part of reality. And he seemed to be really tuned into wanting to tease those invisible elements apart and wanting to look at those to see what kind of different realities he could make through his own poetry and his own metaphors and his own constructions with language.
I kind of want to end it there, but we've got 10 minutes. If you took everything he wrote together, that was the final statement, I think. And I don't know if he knew he was making it. And a lot of people have said that looking at it at that post. I'm sorry, Red Pill, you're going to say something that I interrupted you?
No. I lost my... my train of thought.
Yeah, I know. I've been doing that through the entire show because both of you have been saying these things that make me think a lot, and then I'm following your train of thought, and then I forget what I was going to say about it, and I got to keep going. I should write things down like a professional radio person.
Okay, I regained it. So,
okay.
Yeah, I guess that he, as an artist, knew full well that, you know, the painting doesn't exist in the canvas, right?
Yeah.
The painting really comes into life when it's observed and when it's, you know, appreciated, and it elicits an emotion yeah. in the observer. That's
and when it's created, probably.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like getting back to the idea of the menu, you know, so the meal that you're preparing, the meal is not fully... the meal loses its purpose until it's, you know, tested, you know, until it's eaten, you know, until this is enjoyed by a person. You know?
The same thing you said about music. A bunch of dots on a page doesn't make any difference, but then it's decoded into music, and somewhere between A and B, that the dots on the page and the decoding of the music and you hearing it, there's the A and B there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I got a kind of it might be kind of a nasty question. What do you think the effect? We're talking about this stuff, and it's vitally interesting to us, and we think it's important in trying to understand the UFO thing. How do you think that people studying UFOs and anomalies would think of, you know, if they encounter them, what do you think they think of Bruce Duensing and what we're talking about and what he talked about? That might not be a very charitable question, but
it's a good question, I think. You know, he talks in that last post about how it's actually on Rich Reynolds' site. He talks about the comparisons between ghosts and UAPs or the UFO, and he knows how this is going to terribly offend all the afterlife people, you know, and it's going to also offend all the UFO people as well, too, because he's bringing together, you know, two separate paradigms who see anomalous events and their own kind of, you know, vision of things that they've constructed for themselves. That's their own kind of bit of a predictability piece in terms of this is what it is. And in some cases in the UFO environment, it even goes so far as to, you know, the ETH is still a hardcore piece. And if you challenge that, some people will freak right out on you and think that you're talking, you know, goofy stuff with all this interdimensional weirdo beings coming from other places. So what do they do when they run up against a highly intelligent Bruce Duensing? Do they call him incomprehensible? Do they call these ideas far-fetched, ridiculous confabulations? Or do you see that he's actually trying to stretch the discussion and take it further? That let's leave that ETH piece behind. Let's look and see what else is being offered to us, what other thoughts are being provoked from us. So I think people are very curious. I was wondering the same question is, does any of what we've said tonight make any sense to anyone? And it'll be interesting to see what gets posted to your site about this, because I find Bruce's work very hard, and I hope we've done some bit of justice to trying to highlight that he describes himself as being opinionated and ambivalent, contrary and abstracted. And throughout his work, he's always saying that the same stuff. It could be this, could be that. I'm not married to anything. I'm skeptical of my own self. I'm doubting my own ideas.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was an idea creator. He was like busy mining, you know, anomalous material to use as a metaphor for himself to create new ideas and new investigations. So in that way, he's a great artist. And I think he's also a great ufologist. He's a pioneering ufologist that comes from that the Marcello Truzzi world of dyadic? I can't remember what the phrase is, but that perennial doubt, you know, the doubtful person. And he doubted himself all the time and yet kept coming back for more, kept coming to the well with another set of ideas, you know, another poem to the UFO in some ways. So I wonder how other people will take it. And I hope they see that there's an expansive creative mind that's saying, you know what, let's treat it like it's a Zen cone and see what falls out from that, because there's a lot of ideas that can come from that space.
How about you, RPJ? How do you think people think of this kind of stuff that we've been talking about and that Bruce wrote about? How do you think it will affect the study of weird stuff, anomalies?
On one level, I really don't care that much. You know, I really.
Yay!
You know, because like you guys, I see ufology as an issue of personal transformation.
Yeah.
So maybe a year from now, some teenager is going to stumble upon Bruce's blog completely by accident.
Yeah.
And it's going to read one or two of his blogs, and maybe it will completely blow his or her mind, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, much like that old Jewish saying that if you save one life, you save the world entire. Maybe if you manage to change the mind of one single reader, that's a global paradigm shift in itself.
Yeah.
You know, only one, it's all it takes, you know.
Right. And that person could go on to do who knows what. It might not even be related to UFO stuff. It might be some other field of inquiry where they desperately need somebody who's not hooked into duality or the way used to do things or whatever. We've all had that experience, I think, with people we've encountered, read, talked to, whatever. I mean, I told Robert Anton Wilson he kept me from killing myself, and he went, yeah, I know, that happens. He just didn't even care because about 800 people had told him that, so he's just kind of like – but the thing is, you know, 800 people decided to see what life had to offer, which is, you know – what Red Pill just said. I mean, there it is, concrete in a real sense.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think I should play or edit on here at the end here? Unless there's some specific thing you want to say. Well, we've got 4 minutes here, but I am not stuck to the clock. Time does not exist.
Right.
I have one specific song request.
Okay.
So you know that I always like to end my appearances on Radio Misterioso with a Café Tacuba song.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one particular song that I think will be quite adequate as a homage to Bruce, and that is one that is called Olita del Altamar.
Yeah.
For the first time, I understood the lyrics, even though I liked the song from the beginning, so it's kind of like the idea of visualizing a human life like a wave, you know, in the ocean, and the wave has a very definite state of being, you know, a very limited lifespan. So the wave at some point reaches its cusp, then it inevitably, you know, breaks and recedes back to the ocean. But you can't really say that the wave is destroyed or doesn't exist anymore. You know, it just got back to the source from whence it came. You know, so that's something that it's part of the lyric. You know, how if we understand that we are just here, you know, in a very transitory state, you know, getting that's back right. to his idea, then we have no other choice but to joyfully return to the immensity from whence we all came.
How about you, Robert? I mean, if you got a request for something, I'll put that at the end too.
No, I think I like what RPJ said. I've got a single request in terms of just to maybe express one last idea of Bruce's.
Please. Yeah.
There. And I would like to read that Thomas Wolfe quote that opens. But I wanted to talk a little bit about just the idea of the train station and imagining, you know, that transition that Bruce is on there, because I think there's something very cinematic of imagining the train station that's going to points unknown, you mm-hmm. know, and that as you're traveling down these tracks, the place that you've passed along the way, you'll never be able to return and go back there. And I think that's essential thinking when we think about Bruce Duensing's piece. So if I could just read this quote and a brief comment, and that would be the last thing I want to do. Thomas Wolfe says, "You can't go back home to your family, back home to your childhood, back home to romantic love, back home to a young man's dreams of glory and of fame, back home to exile, to escape to Europe and some foreign land, back home to lyricism, to singing just for singing's sake, back home to asceticism, to one's youthful idea of the artist and the all-sufficiency of art and beauty and love, back home to the ivory tower, back home to places in the country, to the cottage in Bermude, away from all the strife and conflict of the world, back home to the father you have lost and you have been looking for, back home to someone who can help you, save you, ease the burden for you, back home to the old forms and systems of things which once seemed everlasting, but which are changing all the time, back home to the escapes of time and memory." I think that we have in our own lives great longings in ourselves that come out of spaces of time and memory. And I think if we get too attached to those things, we will stop ourselves from moving forward. So I imagine the great gift that Bruce has given to people in his writing is that he's encouraged us to seek new destinations and to kind of push past the things that we've had from the past and to imagine ourselves in future environments and make the things that we do now, these effects, we will discover the cause later on. But let's break out of our old paradigms and let's find new ways of discovering ourselves and not rely on those past modalities. Let's break new ground and see what comes of it.
Well, thank you both so much for being here with me, talking about Bruce Duensing. Both of you were deeply affected by his thinking and writing, as you know I was. And you'll both be back on at some point, I'm sure. We have lots more to talk about. And like I said, thanks again.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you for inviting me, guys.
All right.
Yes, thank you as well. Nice to talk with you, RPG.
Yeah, you too, Robert.
Okay. I'll talk to you both of you guys soon.
Indeed. Good night.
All right. Mm-hmm. See ya.
thought it'd be a good idea to talk about writing a book, which has interested me lately. The relationship between image and imagination and surrealism. That consciousness is imagination. So, I wanted to share with all of you some things that I thought were pretty interesting. And I know a lot of my lost companions are into film. This one, I don't know if you can see this, has no plot, no script. It's just images that are completely amazing. And Sparaka, which is a term the Sufis use for passing along good intentions, good wishes. And the images in this are just freaking incredible. So if you have a chance to see this, it's really worthwhile.